On Tech News Today, France wants to see Google's secret search algorithm and dictate search results. Plus, WikiLeaks posts everything stolen in the Sony Pictures hack, and the Bloomberg terminals that global financial traders depend on crashed for hours today. We'll tell you all about it on Tech News Today.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Tech News Today for Friday, April 17th, 2015. This episode is brought to you by Harry's. For guys who want a great shave experience for a fraction of what you're paying now, go to harrys.com. Get $5 off your first purchase by entering the code TNT when you check out. And by Shutterstock.com. With over 52 million high-quality stock photos, illustrations, vectors, and video clips, Shutterstock helps you take your creative projects to the next level. For 20% off image subscription packages on your new account, go to Shutterstock.com and use the offer code TNT415. Tech News Today is the show where we talk about the tech news with the journalists who report it. Welcome to the show. My name is Mike Elgin, and our co-anchor today is Mashable senior tech correspondent Christina Warren. How you doing, Christina?
I'm good. I'm doing really well. Still super jazzed after the Star Wars reveal yesterday. Very exciting.
You know, to me, the coolest thing was that robot. How did they do that? There's like, it's like a snowman, and there's like a ball on top and a ball on the bottom, and then it doesn't seem to be connected. How did they do that?
I know. I don't know, but that's what's awesome. We had an article where Lance tries to kind of break down and explain how the whole thing works. But I'm just excited that they're making real robots again, that this whole thing isn't just CGI in front of a green screen like the last trilogy was. Like, I'm just super psyched that we're getting like old school Star Wars again, which is totally exciting. And it makes the nerd in me very, very just, I'm giddy.
You're a nerd, but you're also too young to remember what I remember, which is the opening day of the first time Star Wars appeared. I waited in line, which snaked around. I was at the Arlington Theater in Santa Barbara, and it went around the corner and around another block and then around another corner and down another block. And nobody really knew anything. It was like all we knew was the super high tech, you know, special effects, which by today's standards, you know, have to be updated and digitized and all that kind of stuff. But it was a mind-blowing cultural phenomenon back then, and it still is. But this robot, man, this blew my mind. I mean, I saw it in the trailer. You see the sort of like, you see him peek around the corner, and I thought, oh yeah, they updated R2-D2, and then they trotted this thing out at the press conference, and it's actually a functioning, like you say, it's a functioning robot, obviously remote controlled, but still the locomotion on this thing is pretty cool. So I'm really excited about that as well. Well, why don't we jump into the news? We've got tons of great news, and we've got tons and tons of really great interview subjects today. So let's start with the top story. We told you yesterday about the European Commission's antitrust case against Google. Well, longtime Google specialist Amir Afradi at The Information plainly says the EU's case is, quote, rubbish, unquote. Amir joins us now to talk about it. Welcome, Amir.
Thanks for having me.
Now, what's so bad about the EU's antitrust case against Google?
It makes no sense on its face. The premise is completely, completely wrong. And I say this having been covering Google for the past 5 years and actually drawing a lot of ire from some of the top executives at Google, because I've been very passionate about documenting exactly how Google has changed its search engine over time to basically take a lot of traffic from the most valuable search queries to its own vertical search sites like Google Shopping and Google Places and things like that, Flight Search, which I think is fine to do. I don't think Google likes to talk about these sorts of efforts and how they sort of have been really trying to keep more people on the Google vertical search sites as opposed to sending them to Yelp or Kayak or other places. So I'm very critical though about this EU case. It makes no sense, because the whole case is saying that Google is not giving its users the most relevant results in the search engine results, and that is disadvantaging rivals, particularly in the shopping vertical. That's what this case is starting out as. But I just think it's completely bogus, because There is no way to judge what is relevant and what is not relevant. It's Google's search engine. Google has an opinion, and it's giving us that opinion, and we're choosing to take that opinion as users. I'm very, very disconcerted by this whole effort, and I can't tell you what the motivation is on the European side, how political this is, or sort of why they're doing this. It's a very, very unusual case on its face, given everything that's happened to this point. So I actually sympathize very greatly with Google. This is a very big deal for them. This is a very big problem for them.
So, I mean, I guess to maybe play devil's advocate just a tiny bit. I mean, I think you're definitely right. I mean, who is to say what is the best result? Except that Google has an algorithm and their whole kind of technology and kind of their spin. I guess what they're saying is, hey, you know, we're going to show you the result that most users want when they are searching for things. And I mean, if you're getting Google results first, and the only way you can see a competitor result is for them to buy ads, you don't think that that's problematic from a competition standpoint?
I think Google can do whatever it wants with its search engine. And if it's a good search engine, people will use it. And if it's not a good one, you know, maybe people won't use it. I think the whole premise for a lot of this is also that Google is somehow omnipotent, has all this great power and is wielding it and is killing off all these like very, very awesome rivals. But the rivals that have you know, complained in this case are not that awesome. You should try them out. You know, go to Foundum, go to Nextag, and see if the experience is better as a user. This case has nothing to do with users. It has nothing to do with users. Because if this case were about users, the commission, the European Commission, would be looking at whether people are paying the lowest prices for goods online. That's what this is about. It's about shopping vertical, shopping searches. That has nothing to do with the case that's being brought. This has to do with the fact that they, you know, don't believe that the search results are relevant. But it's not looking into, are consumers better off? That has nothing to do with this. So, I don't know if that answers your question, but I just think that Google has no contract with, you know, any website, related to the organic search results. And these you know, websites like Mashable, they get a lot of traffic from Google. If Google suddenly wants to not give Mashable, you know, traffic and decide that it wants to do its own, you know, news site and put that at the top, that's their prerogative. It's their search engine. They can do whatever they want, as far as I'm concerned. Now, people sort of talk about, is this a sort of Microsoft, you know, Internet Explorer case redux? I say absolutely not. But if you look at Android, that's a completely different ballgame. That Android is an ecosystem that is entirely built on contracts and Google sort of telling the licensees of Android what to do next. That is a very real antitrust issue from my perspective. And I think Google's going to have a lot more pain coming from that. But on the search side, I just think this whole thing is completely misguided.
Now, if I understand your argument correctly, you're basically saying, and I'm paraphrasing what I think you said, the Google search engine is Google's opinion about what the most relevant search results are, and that opinion is what Google is. That's the product they're selling, Google's opinion. And that's therefore, right, to meddle with that opinion is to do something really weird, like dictate what, that McDonald's hamburgers should have, chocolate sauce on them or something like that.
This algorithm is a human-based algorithm. There is machine learning to it. Don't get me wrong. There is absolutely machine learning that has gone into this algorithm. But for the longest time, it was really humans tinkering with this thing again and again. And then Google deciding strategically that they wanted to own some of these extra kind of vertical searches on top of the basic searches. So if you're searching for places, you want to go someplace, or you want to search for a product, they decided strategically, we want to own this. We don't want to let somebody else have this traffic. It's very valuable traffic. I do think it's important to point out, Google has been a bit disingenuous in its discussion of this topic. And that's why I think they've been kind of annoyed at some of my coverage in the past, because all I'm doing is laying out, here's what Google is doing. It used to be that they would push traffic to all these other product search or comparison shopping sites. Now they've decided they don't want to do that anymore. As long as we're being upfront about what Google is doing and everyone is sort of aware, I think that it's fine. I think Google can do whatever it wants with its search engine.
Google is one of the few companies that has basically turned down business based on its, you know, mistreatment by government. Specifically, I'm talking about China specifically, and that was a lot. I mean, they gave up the future of massive revenue if they would have really done the Apple thing and really done everything that they could possibly do to get into China. They didn't. They moved it to Hong Kong, and now they're on the outs in China.
And I'm glad you bring this up. I'm glad you bring this up because this kind of gets to why is it that we're seeing so much pushback against the Google search engine? And I think that there are a couple of very good reasons. In China, certainly they had a business in China and they were, you know, self-censoring results to the government's wishes. But the Chinese government was not going to be okay with a U.S. company telling its citizens how to get information and being that gateway to information. I think just, again, to use the word strategically again, if you're a sovereign nation, you want to control those avenues of information as best you can. To have an American company come in and be an important player in information, it's a little bit disconcerting. So the Chinese government was giving plenty of advantages to Baidu. And I think no matter what, doesn't matter what Google would have done, Baidu would have won that war. And that's why Google decided ultimately that it probably wasn't worth battling Baidu for that market. I think in Europe, there are parallels here because the governments there, again, I can't tell you the exact motivations for all these things. And you know, you brought up before the show this point about the French government now having a bill that's actually moving its way that will require Google or search engines, they don't call out Google, to reveal their, you know, how they do search ranking and actually give people choices for other search engines. I think this goes back to that point. Sovereign nations don't like, and you know, a company from another nation playing that strategically important role. This is all pretty funny to me because Google's power has been declining. Google's revenue growth has been declining. They have serious problems. They're not faking it. Google's issues in mobile devices, they're not faking it. These are real problems that they have. They have plenty of advantages too. But I think that there are many people who are saying this is the apex. We've passed the apex of Google power. And in fact, they're going to be more and more challenged over time. That might be a correct statement.
Okay, very quickly, you know, it occurs to me that, you know, this whole thing boiled down to the Google Shopping product, I guess you could call it, that Google has in comparison with other competitors. That I'm pretty sure that's not a significant part of their business. If they were to respond to all this by closing Google Shopping and stopping the sort of presentation of shopping-like sites in the way that they do, that would be pretty devastating to those competitors who are presumably complaining, wouldn't it?
Well, I don't think they would shut down, you know, shopping search queries. I actually think this is a very big deal for Google. They made a change 3 years ago. What used to be, you remember Frugal a long time ago, like in 2006, there was Frugal, where you could actually go and do product related searches, on right. Google, and that kind of property remained. But when you first did a product search on Google and you looked for like a vacuum cleaner or something, Google would have organic results. It would have some ads, it would have organic results, and then it would have links to the Google Shopping search engine that you could click on and then do more searches. That Google Shopping search result was often sort of intermixed with the organic search results. And people could point to that and say, hi, you know, your Google Shopping link is always really high up. Why is that? It looks weird. You know, there are organic searches everywhere above it and below it. Why is yours always sort of near the top? So Google said, enough with that. We're actually going to make a special advertising only shopping, you know, search box at the very top of the page. And that will lead people to do more product searches. And they actually thought that, they can make a lot more money from this because it's all advertising. To even be part of Google Shopping, you have to pay Google. It did actually improve that service because the retailers are now making sure that the information that they're paying for is very, very accurate. And obviously, you have Google Shopping Express now where you can get stuff delivered to you if you live in certain cities in the United States. So it's actually a very, very important property for Google. It is a multi-billion-dollar business, huge multi-billion-dollar business. They don't break it out, so I don't know exactly. But to have to change that, I don't know how material in terms of revenue the change is going to be. But whatever change they end up having to make in Europe, because they're probably going to lose this case in all likelihood, this will have a negative impact on their revenue for sure.
Well, on that bummer, and speaking of information that you pay for, Amir Afradi is at theinformation.com. That's a paid site, ad-free paid site, and you should subscribe to it if you're serious about tech news. And you can follow him on Twitter at Amir, A-M-I-R. Thank you so much for joining us today, Amir.
Thank you for having me.
More news in a sec, but first, let's talk about Harry's, the way to have a great, great shave experience. And it's all about the experience, not just the shaving experience, but the buying experience. The blades cost about half of what you're paying for inferior blades, and Harry's blades are superior because they have their own factory. They set up the entire process from grinding high-grade steel to sending razors to the door. They do it. It's basic, like bean to bar, they call it in the chocolate industry, or hole to hole, they call it in the oil industry. This is they control the whole process, so you get fantastic products. And one of the things that I really like about Harry's products is their shaving cream. This is great stuff. And they say that the shaving cream comes from the same chemists who make shaving cream for the highest end brands. And of course, they're going to sell you super high quality shaving cream and razor blades, all at a fraction of the price that you will pay elsewhere at the drugstore or wherever it is you're buying razors, supermarket. It's time to change your morning routine and have a much, much better experience shaving with Harry's, and it's super easy. So how inexpensive is this? Well, their least expensive kit cost $15. It's called the Truman Set, and you get a really high quality razor, that shaving cream I told you about, and three blades. And it comes in a really nice box. They'll ship it right to your door with no shipping charges. So $15 is what you pay. Now, you can get it for $10, and I'm going to tell you how. Go to harrys.com and get $5 off the first purchase with using the offer code TNT. That's harrys.com and enter TNT, and you have to enter that at checkout. So go through the whole process, and you'll enter TNT at checkout for that discount. And we thank Harry's for their support of Tech News Today. Now, Amir Afradi referenced a French Senate situation there. Essentially, what's happening there is that the French Senate yesterday voted to require search engine companies like Google to reveal their search engine algorithms to regulators to enable enforcement of antitrust laws and rules. And the lawmakers also voted to require search engines to display at least three rivals on the home page of any search. And one of those rivals must be a French company. The bill goes to the National Assembly for a final vote this month. This, to me, in my opinion, is a rabid act of protectionism. I mean, this is insane, dictating search results. For example, if there are only two rivals, then a company could just go into business just because they would be required by law to be listed on the homepage as a third rival. It's just crazy talk. Christina Warren, I don't know if you have a comment on the French bill, but this is literally one of the craziest things I've ever seen European politicians do.
No, and that's saying a lot, because European politicians like to do a lot of crazy things, at least, you know, comparatively when it comes to kind of a, you know, our differences with speech and commerce and separation of, you know, public and private. You know, their rules are obviously very different than our own. But I have never seen anything like this where they're basically asking companies to open up their intellectual property.
Yeah, which is the whole business.
Which is the whole thing. I mean, you know, Google's algorithm has been its kind of secret sauce for years. I mean, Google, most people don't realize this, they have APIs for almost everything but their search engine, you know, and that's for a reason. It's something that's very, very, you know, important to them. And so to basically say, you've got to tell us how this works. I mean, we're going to be talking with Barry from SEO Roundtable in a couple of minutes. I mean, basically, they're kind of saying, okay, just let everybody reverse engineer us and find a way to game the system, I guess. I mean, I don't get it. It seems completely insane. And frankly, it seems like one of those things where the politicians can make the statement in Parliament basically get you know, plaudits from some of their citizens. But actually trying to enforce this is going to be impossible.
Absolutely true. And it's a tragic state of affairs, I tell you. Let us know what you think of Europe's and France's war on Google. Send email to tnt@twit.tv and let us know what you think. WikiLeaks yesterday posted all the content stolen by the hackers who breached Sony Pictures Entertainment last year. The site set up a searchable archive containing 30,000 documents from the company and 170,000 emails, many of which were sent by famous actors. Natalie Robamed is a staff writer for Forbes and joins us now. How are you doing, Natalie?
I'm good. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being on. The initial hack and leaks were catastrophic for Sony Pictures' reputation, not to mention its relationship with talent. How bad is this new development?
Well, I think it's just awful timing for Sony, because they probably thought that they had put the worst behind them and that they would be able to move on and the public would forget all the things that had been said. But the publication of these the hack on WikiLeaks just makes it available to a far wider audience. It's far easier to access. And I think a lot more people are going to be reading them.
Yeah, most definitely. I mean, I was one of the people who, you know, disclosure, I was going through a lot of those documents when they came out and looking for different stories and had access, you know, to most of these things. And quite frankly, I mean, most of the documents, the emails are really, I guess, where the quote unquote juicy, gossipy things are. But most of the stuff are just internal sales documents and really boring information. But were there any revelations that you kind of seen prop up that we haven't already seen before? I'm just basically seeing a rehash of the same covers that we had, I guess, in December. But have you seen anything new come out of this that we haven't seen in the past?
So there's nothing that's particularly caught my eye yet. I haven't been able to read everything.
Right.
But as you know, I'm a financial journalist and covering media and entertainment. So for me, this is a treasure trove of what people have been earning, their back ends. And I think that's something that is going to come to light as, you know, just as time goes on and as people have more chance to look through it.
Now, Natalie, these documents contain personal information about employees, including, and I think the employees really are the biggest victims here by far.
Yes.
And these include social security numbers, home addresses, and phone numbers. And now, thanks to WikiLeaks, these are easily searchable. What public good could these posts possibly provide? And how does WikiLeaks justify the creation of this searchable database?
WikiLeaks says that it's doing a public service by letting people have an insight into a massive multinational. I think, you know, it's a very tricky ethical question, and different publications have chosen to cover or not cover as extensively the leaks just for that reason, that it is an invasion of privacy. But, you know, it's just a very tricky question.
Yeah, I've been on a Facebook group with a bunch of former Sony employees who, since these revelations have started, have been very worried about, you know, identity theft and those sorts of things. To me, that was kind of the part about this that seemed the most egregious. I understand releasing the emails. I understand releasing some of the back-end documents. But the payroll information, at least not redacted, and in the past, WikiLeaks has gone through the process of at least redacting some of that information, seems to be problematic. Do you foresee, now that this is out in the open, any potential for Sony? I mean, they've already been the subject of class action lawsuits and lawsuits by their current and former employees. But now that this information is obviously searchable and accessible and has access to a wider audience, do you foresee those legal challenges, especially when it comes to personal identity and identity theft, of getting worse for the company?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a privacy expert, but I can really imagine that their problems are only just beginning. You know, I'm sure that they're doing their best to get this taken down from WikiLeaks. But their employees, I have no doubt, are very angry and have every right to be.
Well, there's all kinds of details in there. People are going to be zeroing in on the celebrity element. And so we'll zoom in on one celebrity element. We learned in all this, or at least I learned, I didn't know this before, that Channing Tatum writes like a moron. It has to be said. His emails are absolutely, they're like a 9-year-old. It's just unbelievable. So, you know, look it up. Natalie Robomed is at Forbes.com, and you can follow her on Twitter at N-A-T-R-O-B-E. Thank you so much for joining us today, Natalie.
Thank you for having me.
Google changed its search engine so that when you search from an Android device, the results may include Android apps. Barry Schwartz writes for Search Engine Land and is the publisher of Search Engine Roundtable and joins us now. How you doing, Barry?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you. Now, a Google representative posted on Google Plus that this is a very big deal, and you agreed. Why is this such a big deal?
So prior to this, the only way for your Android app content to show within the Google search results is for the person to have the Android app installed on their device. The only way for this to work is if your actual app has something called app indexing. And app indexing is a way for you as a developer to communicate to Google that these sections or these pages within the actual app itself are related to these types of queries or these types of keywords. And when somebody does a search in Google on their Android device, prior to yesterday, the only way for content within the app to be displayed and hyperlinked in the on an Android search is if the app was installed on your device. Now Google's saying, as long as the Android app has app indexing on it, they're going to show the app if it's relevant to the query, if the content in the app is relevant to the query, to the searcher, and enable them to actually click on a button to install it. So it's interesting because if you think about this, you have somebody searching, clicking on an app, then they don't get the immediate result. They have to actually say, I want to install it, approve the install, wait for the install to happen, and then after the install happens, they have to hit click up, open, and then eventually it will take them to the actual content within the app. So it's a really delayed process to actually get to the relevant content. But at the same time, I think Google really wants Android developers and hopefully in the future iOS developers to implement what they call app indexing.
So for developers to actually be able to take advantage of this, they need to have app indexing turned on inside their app, and then it will start to show up in Google's mobile results for Android. Is that correct?
Yeah, technically, it's you submitting a data feed to Google, kind of like an XML sitemap, through something called Google Webmaster Tools. And then you also have, currently, you have to have a web interface for it. So for example, Yelp, they might have a website with restaurant results, and they also have a Android app with restaurant results. So in the app indexing protocol, you have to specify that the, I guess, restaurant A listed in the mobile app references restaurant A listed on the mobile or desktop website.
So this sounds really cool. Do you think that this is kind of trying to take on some of the things that Facebook announced at F8 and some of the ways they've been trying to encourage app search and surfacing apps through their mobile app and on their site? Or what do you think, I guess, is the real impetus for Google trying to do this? Since, as you said, there are a lot of steps you have to go through to install the app to actually get that result.
So that's one. They obviously want to be able to understand the users across, you know, mobile apps and desktop. But they also know that a lot of people are spending a lot of time in apps as opposed to on mobile web. And because people are spending a lot of time within apps, native apps, they want to be able to make sure that their searchers can find and discover content within those apps. And for Google to do that, they need the developer to give them a way to understand what content is within the app. And the only way for Google to have that is something called app indexing, where a developer specifically tells Google what is in the app. So because of that, Google wants, they know people are spending a lot of time in apps, and this is the only way for them to provide that answer.
Now, Barry, you mentioned in one of your articles that an algorithmic update is coming next week that will affect all mobile searches. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so on April 21st, Google's been prepping us about this, or the webmaster community about this, since February. And on April 21st, which is next week, this only affects mobile searches. So if you're on an iPhone, Android phone, and you're searching for something on Google on your mobile device, the search results should actually drastically change from where it is today on a mobile device to where it is on April 21st going forward. Google's going to go ahead and maybe promote or demote, promote mobile-friendly websites and maybe demote unmobile-friendly websites for mobile searches. And Google's been pushing this. They've been answering questions across the community on how do I make my website mobile friendly? There's a lot of tools Google released for this. But right now, yeah, this is gonna go live next week on April 21st. And supposedly this is gonna be pretty large. Google has gone on record saying this is gonna be larger than their Panda algorithm, which was something back in February, I think 2013 or so, or 2011, where that affected about, I think, 11% of all search queries. Obviously, again, this is only mobile, but I would assume about half of Google's search queries these days are done over mobile devices. So it's pretty significant.
So Google is going to make this change next week, and the European Union is going to object to it publicly in 5 years. So we'll look forward to that. Barry Schwartz is at SEORoundtable.com, at RustyBrick.com, and also on Twitter at RustyBrick. Thanks for joining us today, Barry.
Thank you for having me.
Now, Christina, you have a hard stop. You got a boogie.
I do. I've got to get out of here. But continue on with the show and have a great weekend.
Okay. You can catch up with Christina Warren at film_girl. Thank you so much, Christina. We'll see you next time.
Thanks, Mike.
All right. Bye-bye. Well, it turns out that it's possible for outsiders to actually influence Chinese policy. Who knew? China has suspended cybersecurity rules that prevented Chinese banks from using foreign technology after major opposition from the United States and other governments. Corey Bennett writes for The Hill and joins us to talk about this. Welcome to you, Corey.
Hey, Mike. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great, thanks. Now, what were these cybersecurity rules that President Obama and others found so objectionable?
So it's several things. There is a broad set of rules that are under this kind of counterterrorism, anti-terrorism in cyberspace rules that include a number of provisions, installing Beijing-approved encryption, handing over source code to government officials for inspection, submitting yourself to audits on a regular basis from the government. As you can imagine, a lot of this involves turning over intellectual property, potentially giving access to customer data. The issue that has popped up this week has been specifically the banking technology rules. All banks in China had started rolling out their plans for how to comply with these laws, which would essentially reduce their use of foreign technology. A number of companies had said they just would simply not comply with the rules if they did go through. So we had seen banks start to comply with those specific rules, and that's the one that is being suspended right now. They are going to be revised and probably reissued. What that looks like is anyone's guess. It's very hard to tell with the Chinese government. But that's the specific issue that we saw come to the fore this week.
Now, the Chinese government does not like to be threatened publicly with any sort of retaliation. Were they threatened privately? I know that some members of the U.S. government traveled to China to talk behind closed doors about all this. Were there any threats of retaliation behind this? Do we know why they changed their tune?
I wouldn't call it threats of retaliation, but I would say a couple things. One, you're right, it is very rare that China would, one, be challenged on these kind of things and back down even in part. You know, in reading many reports about this, I couldn't find many examples of past instances in which China has done such a thing. Two, I do think that the U.S. was very strongly worded, more so than I've seen it be, about other hacking that goes on from China. We know that China is hacking the U.S. military, U.S. critical infrastructure, U.S. government agencies, U.S. healthcare insurers, and the U.S. has not been as strongly worded about any of that as it was about this. You know, we saw Treasury Secretary Jack Lew went over, Commerce Secretary Penny Pritzker went over. Obama called President Xi directly to talk about these things. I mean, that's very rare. Obama and Xi don't talk that often about cyber. So I think it's important to stress how much the Obama administration was focusing on this. And from what I've heard from officials at the government, it was actually the Treasury Department ongoing negotiations. Lew was over there in late March, the 30th, 31st. And after he visited, apparently there were lots of intense negotiations behind the scenes that we didn't know about until yesterday, in which they were negotiating this delay, this suspension, probably what the revised rules are going to look like. And it was announced in a meeting on Wednesday. It was announced in a meeting. Treasury officials met with a Chinese delegation, and the Chinese delegation told them that they had made this decision. So you have to imagine there was some pressure. We saw both Lew and Pritzker say that U.S. businesses were going to take millions and billions of dollars of their business out of China if the rules went through. I would consider that perhaps a kind of threat. It's certainly not a very overt one, but they certainly were putting the pressure on.
Now, we're trying to get a handle over here in all these stories that we report coming out of China about the sort of the new China under Xi Jinping, who is a real hardliner. I mean, he's really cracking down on everything from, you know, censorship. He's censoring everything. He's cracking down on making people register for social networks. He's doing all these kinds of things. Do we know, do you have a sense, I guess, is the question of how much these banking rules in the first instance had to do with actual security, with the claimed intent, or how much of it was just protectionism? Do you have a sense of where those rules were coming from in the first place?
It's hard not to see this as part of a larger trend. As you mentioned, China has struck has cracked down on VPNs, for example. Those used to be kind of tacitly accepted. No more. They've launched new and unique and unseen before cyber attacks against people who are critical of them. Great Fire is one in particular. The Chinese government has gone after GitHub to try to get New York Times content taken down. These are all new and unprecedented steps. There was actually recently a wonderful piece in The New Yorker that touched on these subjects and mentioned China as one of the few, if perhaps the only, developed country in the world that has slower internet and less internet today than it did this day a year ago, which is amazing to think about considering how vast their tech sector is and how rapidly it's expanding. So it's hard not to see these rules as part of that broader trend. At the same time, it's worth noting that many countries are doing these kind of things, including the United States. The United States is having its own battle about what encryption standards we are going to expect from companies. Should we require some type of encryption backdoor? Should we require or have some sort of legal framework for the government to have guaranteed access to consumer data? Those are issues that the government in this country is dealing with as well. China has dealt with them in one fashion. The U.S. is still figuring out how it's going to deal with it. Sources say that Obama is preparing a report right now on his different options for encryption. But I do think it's worth noting that while this is part of a larger trend in China, this specific issue of encryption and what government requires of companies on encryption is one that every country, including the U.S., is dealing with right now.
And it's interesting you draw parallels between the Chinese actions and the U.S. government's actions to a certain extent. You'd mentioned the GitHub attack by China. That was actually using a new approach to external censorship called the Great Canon. And that was apparently based on technology used by the NSA and UK's GCHQ, which they use for counterterrorism and surveillance, which the Chinese are using for external censorship. So that's it's a very interesting world we're living in. And I guess it's easier to do these things in China because you don't have those pesky second parties to deal with. You just have the one party. So it's everything goes much more smoothly.
Well, absolutely.
Well, Corey Bennett is at thehill.com, and you can follow him on Twitter at Corey_Bennett with two N's and two T's. Thanks for joining us today, Corey.
Yeah, of course. Thanks, Mike.
All right. Let us know what you think about China's latest actions in all this, either the crackdown on the banking or the reversal. Send email to tnt@twit.tv. We want to hear your opinion. Well, Bloomberg's financial terminals went offline for hours globally today, causing big disruptions for traders. Josie Cox writes about the European markets for the Wall Street Journal and joins us now by telephone. Welcome to you, Josie.
Hi.
Now, before we talk about the outage, can you tell us what these terminals are used for and how important they are for its users?
Absolutely. Yeah, no, as you say, I mean, this is Bloomberg terminals have kind of become the go-to tool for anyone who's really active in markets, whether that be traders or brokers or investors, and also some journalists use these terminals. They provide data, they provide prices for various asset classes, commodities, fixed income, currencies. But they also provide news headlines on just what's going on globally across the world, from politics to economics. And then perhaps most crucially for many people, they also provide a chat function. So a lot of traders especially have reverted or have been using the Bloomberg chat function almost exclusively to communicate with their counterparties in the market and to do their job, basically.
So it's basically a social network as well. Now, I learned from your article that something like 325,000 terminal subscriptions exist globally, and these cost like $20,000 per year. So this is why Michael Bloomberg is so rich. now, Josie, the blackout hit just after European markets opened. How long did the outage last, and how bad was this for those European markets?
Yeah, you're right. It started just after the European market opened, which is actually one of the busiest times in European markets. Everyone's kind of shuffling and adjusting to get ready for the day. The outage, it's not 100% clear how long it lasted. There were kind of conflicting reports. Traders who I was talking to were saying that it was kind of sporadically coming back online and then it was dropping out again. So that must have been incredibly frustrating. The whole issue seemed to be resolved around early afternoon in Europe. So it did last a significant amount of time, sort of 3 to 4 hours.
Wow. And do we know what caused it? I think there was an initial assumption that it might be terrorism or something like that. But is there any solid data on what actually caused this to happen?
not really. Bloomberg did put out a statement later in the afternoon saying that it was technical issues to do with software and hardware. But I mean, as you can imagine, when something like this happens, rumors spread very quickly on other social media networks, Twitter, etc. People were saying all kinds of things. But I think, you know, it can be assumed that it was an internal issue and that there weren't any sort of there were no terror attacks or hacking attacks involved in this.
Well, I certainly hope not, and hope they fix whatever it is that mm-hmm. caused it. Josie Cox is at WSJ.com, and you can follow her on Twitter at Josie Cox WSJ. Thank you so much for joining us today, Josie.
Thanks for having me. Thank you.
All right. Well, Apple is partnering with U.S. solar panel maker SunPower to build two solar power plants in China's southwestern Sichuan province, which borders Tibet. The two companies will co-own the projects, which will operate with a capacity of 40 megawatts. The solar plants will be built in a remote area used for grazing yaks. I don't know what the yaks are going to think about this, but it's probably good for the environment. Apple claims that they try to be carbon neutral, I think is the term, everywhere they go. And this applies almost everywhere that Apple has a footprint, except for China. And so this is designed to sort of reverse that whole situation. Well, we reported yesterday that Etsy's IPO priced the company at $1.8 billion, and I said then that the valuation was too low and that it should be at least $3 or $4 billion. Well, turns out the market agrees with me. After one day of trading, the stock price more than doubled, valuing the company at around $4 billion. That's more like it, as far as I'm concerned. Well, in product update news, Google yesterday updated Chrome for iOS. A new Notification Center widget enables the ability to launch a new tab or initiate a voice search directly from the Today view. The new app also supports 1Password and LastPass, so you can automate your password situation, and that's good for security. Well, a little bit more news coming up, but first, let's talk about Shutterstock. I've been blogging since before blogs existed. That's right, before the whole blog thing took place. I used to handcraft a blog back in the late 90s, I think I started. And I got to tell you, what the biggest change in blogging is the rise of visual information. You have to be visual. If you see the best blogs, the most popular blogs, they always have amazing photography, amazing illustration. And so unless you are a photographer yourself, where are you going to get those great images in order to be a great blog? Well, you're going to get them at Shutterstock.com because it's the place to find such things. You can choose from over 52 million, with an M, high-quality stock photos, illustrations, vectors, and video clips. And it's very, very affordable. And, of course, they add 385,000 images every single week. So if you searched Shutterstock.com last week, search again because there are hundreds of thousands of more images online. You can check them out very easily with their amazing search tools. And let me tell you, if you got an iPad, you have to get their award-winning iPad app. It is so pleasurable to use. You just swipe through all these photographs very conveniently and very beautifully. It's really a work of art, this iPad app. So you got to check that out. You can try Shutterstock today by signing up for a free account. No credit card needed. Just start an account and begin using Shutterstock to help imagine what your next project could be and save favorite images to a lightbox to view later. I love those lightboxes, by the way. Once you decide to purchase, use the offer code TNT415 and new accounts will receive 20% off image subscription packages. It's already a low price and you'll get 20% off. That's Shutterstock.com, and for 20% off image subscription packages on new accounts, use offer code TNT415. And we thank Shutterstock for their support of Tech News Today. Our TNT fan of the day is Sean Davis, who posted this picture on Twitter. He wrote that he was sick in bed last Friday, but smiling because of Tech News Today. And I don't know how Christina Warren got top billing there. She's on the screen closest, and I'm back in the distance. But what are you going to do? You know, very cool. How do you watch or listen to TNT? Just record a video or take a picture of yourself or your setup and post it on Google Plus, Twitter, or Facebook, and use the hashtag #HowIWatchTNT so we can find it. Well, you can subscribe to Tech News Today by going to twit.tv/TNT, and you can find the subscription drop-down menus on the left side of the page. We encourage you to do that. If you'd like to help us grow our audience, here's how you can do it. Post a link to TNT on the social media site of your choice and tag three friends that you think would enjoy the show, along with your recommendation to subscribe. You can also watch us live every weekday at 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern, 1800 UTC at live.twit.tv or in the app or browser plugin of your choice. You can find those apps and plugins at twit.tv/apps. If you're ever near Sonoma County, come on in and watch us as part of our studio audience. Send email to tickets@twit.tv if you want to come in. You can also follow us on Twitter. Tech News Today TV is our Twitter name, and you can follow me on Vine. Just go to vine.co/mike.elgin. Let us know what you think. Send an email to tnt@twit.tv or call 260-TNT-SHOW. And don't miss Tech News Tonight at 4 p.m. Pacific every single weeknight. That, ladies and gentlemen, is the Tech News Today. This show is produced by Jason Cleanthes and edited by Brian Burnett. My name is Mike Elgin. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you Monday.